Hello, this is the HSJ Health Check podcast. I'm your host, Annabelle Collins, and I'm joined by Ben Clover and Dave West. On this week's episode, more on the debate around manager regulation, with the latest intervention from Shadow Health Secretary Wes Streeting, who wrote to the NHS this week calling for the system to change. Also this week, more on an investigation into audiology services. After recent revelations, more trusts are involved and more children have been harmed because of care failures. Let's talk about manager regulation first. The spotlight has very much remained on this issue since the Letby verdict last month. And as I said, the latest intervention has been from Wes Streeting, the Shadow Health Secretary, and also Steve Barclay has seemed to be supportive of it too. So Dave, considering this, do you think it might actually happen this time, as this is not the first time manager regulation has been in the news?
Yeah, it does. There is a lot of strong signals that that this time may be different, particularly that political support and apparent momentum with the current Secretary of State seeming fairly keen on some form of regulation. And just this week, as you said, Wes Streeting being very clear in that Labour is committed to doing something, and committed to doing something quite substantial, rather than a sort of more piecemeal fit and proper person, or sort of just limited disbarring kind of approach, which has been toyed with before. So there is that kind of support. There's NHS England as well, as seems to be taking this seriously in the wake of the Letby verdicts. NHS England held meetings last week, the Chief Executive Amanda Pritchard, meetings with kind of national organisations and groups, trying to kind of garner their views and start discussing this. But also a meeting with local chairs and chief executives to think about and kind of garner their views on that, and views about other pressures upon healthcare leaders. It wasn't all about regulation and Letby, but that was a feature. And indeed, you know, some of the people who were there who we've heard from have said actually this, you know, there did seem to be broad support for some form of management regulation. And indeed, you know, managers themselves have for a long time not been particularly strongly against that, with the very enormous proviso, you know, as long as it's done properly in the way that in a sort of way that will enhance improve standards of NHS management, and not simply a way that's kind of feeding the trolls and elements of the media and politics who kind of like want to attack NHS managers. And perhaps that's something we'll come back to, because actually, you know, some of this sort of accountability stuff isn't that really what people are thinking about, and is someone to blame? And if regulation is actually not going to aid that, then maybe it'd be, you know, counterproductive anyway. But as I said, there is support. Wes Streeting in particular has written to NHS providers chief executive and NHS Confederation chief executive, and the responses from them are sort of reasonably sort of positive, albeit very high level as well. So again, the sector is not against this, and I think, Annabelle, you've spoken to managers in partnership who have been not particularly against it, as long as it's done in the right way for many years, really.
Yeah, I think they're quite clear that I think it's just over half, or about half of their members are in support of it. I don't think there's an opposition for managers. And I'm sure, you know, both of you speak to chief execs and chairs, and those I've spoken to haven't been against it either. It's kind of like, well, what value is this going to add? How is it going to be done?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the start of the counter case, is it's just really big and enormous and complicated and probably expensive to some degree. And you know, we require legislation, we're required to have a clear plan about what you want to do and how you're going to achieve it. And, you know, part of the reason we're not going to get in today into what actually, what are those issues about how you do it, because, you know, we haven't thought about it. And I'm not sure anyone's given it great thought beyond this kind of early disbarring thing. You know, it was really being important, complicated job to come up with that thing if you're going to basically create not only a professional regulation but create a profession. You know, I mean, who's in it, who's out of it, and what do you require of them? So all that is a reason why actually in a number of, you know, once you get start going down that road, it may never still happen, are the kind of things that have prevented it from happening before. And, you know, there's a public inquiry which is waiting to happen, while NHS England and politicians and everyone are considering it. There is a sense that, well, perhaps that's only really because there is a kind of an appetite for accountability right now, when there's no, you know, NHS England or NHS management cannot come out right now and say, no, we're not having it, you know, because there's such scrutiny of apparent failures by senior managers. They all these people may you know, simply be of the view, well, we better give it some serious thought for now, but, you know, let's see in a couple of years time, by the time the public inquiry actually gets to be completed, A, what the public inquiry thinks and what it finds, and B, you know, maybe everyone's appetite for this sort of stuff will have moved on. So I do think, although you know, a lot of sensible people of the view now, well, I don't think it is going to happen, I mean, there's still a lot of there's still a lot of water to go under that, go through to pass under the bridge.
What did you think of Wes's intervention? Did it kind of bring anything new to the table, or was it kind of the same arguments?
Well, I mean, it's the important thing that, you know, this person who everyone thinks is going to be in power from some point next year is fairly committed, clearly committed to it. So there's a sort of you know, that's the significance there. But it did, you know, it, as I say, it is consulting NHS providers and NHS Confederation. And I did ask, you know, Labour, well, why are you doing that when NHS England apparently already thinking about it? And I think part of what Labour is emphasising is we are talking about a big, wide, open kind of system of manager regulation, which actually could do, you know, bring improvement and cultural change and sort of professionalisation and this raising of standards, rather than a sort of narrow disbarring, which they're feeling is there. And I think NHS England's a bit unclear, and, you know, they're very much at the early stage light discussions, but I think maybe NHS England's focus is on this sort of, well, what do we do about that disbarring recommendation from CARC recommendation number 5 or something, which was parked, and, you know, are they just going back to narrowly consider that, whereas Labour's opened up the debate more widely. There was some people have noted in Wes's statement and letter that he sent to those NHS organisations a very clear cut judgment about what had happened in Chester, and that, you know, specifically that specific senior managers had failed to listen in a very clear way, which, as you know, you've and Lawrence discussed on the previous podcast, very excellent, worth listening back podcast about the Letby stuff. You know, actually, that is not that is still disputed. That does very much appear to be the case, but that is still disputed. And while investigations have been carried out, Sir Amelius commissioned by the trust to look into exactly what the management response was, unfortunately, the trust is not publishing it, and is sort of trying to imply it's not completed and that work, and is not publishing it. So we don't have a sort of published comprehensive investigation of what the managers did do. And Wes was in a sense a little bit you know, fueling the flames of that by being very clear about that. And you know, I think everyone in NHS management and around would be is concerned that any sort of new system is coming out of a kind of you know, fire and brimstone attack on NHS management rather than a more constructive approach. So I think there's sort of positives and negatives in the Wes Streeting intervention there, but that, you know, perhaps brings us a bit onto that sort of, well, what, you know, what actually is this trying to achieve with a system of regulation, and would any system of regulation achieve that?
And as you said, David, it'd be a massive piece of work to bring this in, essentially creating a new regulator perhaps, and deciding who's going to be regulated and what. As I think we've, you know, we've also said that trusts are very heavily regulated institutions. And you've mentioned the FPPT and the fitness to practice guidance, and the NHS England refreshed that really recently. Is there a debate to be had about whether the current system current regulation could be reformed rather than creating a whole new system, which might take a very long time and might not actually achieve an awful lot more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that for all the reasons we've gone through, there are some quite possibly good reasons for introducing a system of regulation for management, even though it's a really big and complex job. You know, there's some pretty self-evident good reasons to do that, but it does seem to be a bit of an easy focus at this time for NHS management and politicians, because who are, you know, out for blood in a sense, and you know, and understandably so, but such terrible things happened and been allowed to happen, but it kind of focusing the anger in a way on certain specific individuals, which, as we've said, you know, appears to be not unreasonable but maybe unfair, and focusing it on this question of well, let's have a new regulator that'll help, whereas really you're just sort of generating a kind of new, you know, new structures which and we have a lot of structures at the moment of not of professional regulation, but the NHS and its organizations very heavily regulated, the Care Quality Commission and a whole bunch of other obviously professional regulators, which often cover many managers, clinical, financial, legal, etc. And then the performance, you know, NHS England, whether you choose to call that a regulator or a sort of system manager now, you know, we used to talk about things like monitor as regulators, you now probably describe it as a sort of system management job. But, you know, basically the NHS chief executives and boards are very closely performance managed by NHS England and closely regulated by the CQC. So given whatever we're trying to achieve out of all this, you know, presumably things like listening better to whistleblowers, prioritising safety, spotting where major things like let be are happening, but also, you know, things have been brought into this other maternity failures and failures in the care of in children at King's College, which has been highlighted again at King's College Hospital, has been highlighted again recently, you know, all the things we're going to try and do that. Well, should we not also be examining what the current infrastructure, which is very substantial, you know, in regulating the NHS, what that does to this kind of environment, and particularly, you know, it comes back to the culture word, doesn't it? A culture of apparently distrusting clinicians, a culture of stifling whistleblowers, a culture of not prioritizing safety. You know, people feel those things are associated. The word of culture doesn't necessarily get under the skin of why those things are happening. But I think it's easy to externalize it and say, oh, let's have a new regulator, rather than examining what the current structures and organizations and leaders are doing about that issue. And a number of people have started to raise this point at culture and whistleblowing and saying, well, you know, there's a Rob Behrens, the ombudsman, has talked a bit about this. And I think there's a piece we're due to publish soon from Health Watch, talking about saying actually structural change is not necessarily the best way to improve these cultural aspects of listening to people, to staff and to patients. And Amanda Pritchard did recognise in one of her notes out to the service on Monday that you know, the NHS does need to reflect on this sort of culture and safety and quality as a whole, but again, it's not specifically saying, well, hang on a minute, we have an assurance framework, we have performance management regime, we recruit chief executives and approve the in many cases and certainly have a say in it, and we approve the recruitment of boards of chairs in many cases as NHS England. You know, what could we do, you know, rather than thinking up a new system? So I do think there's a little bit missing there, and you know, speaks to some of the kind of what's happened in Chester and with the leaders who've left Chester and of course were appointed in other parts of the country. People have the idea that, again, you've discussed this with Lawrence Dunhill, I think, on the previous episode, but people have the idea that this would have made a difference in Chester. That's not absolutely clear, nor to the subsequent roles. Whereas actually, you know, the chief executive who came into Chester after Tony Chambers and did listen to the doctors and started a kind of turnaround program has now fallen out enormously with the NHS, basically. You know, she's not linking that to what happened with Letby. It's not a sort of, doesn't appear to be a kind of Letby cover up type thing. But I think it does resonate with all these cultural questions of, what, hang on a minute, how has the NHS managed to fall out with a leader who did appear to be tuned in, you know, to the to patient safety issues, perhaps, like, you know, perhaps sort of too tuned into patient safety issues. She was sort of not willing to compromise on other things which she was perhaps asked to compromise on, although, you know, all that case is yet to be heard. But you know, and that chief executive Susan Gilby had also you know, had a been involved in a big patient safety cultural debate in the previous job at Wirral, where, you know, the execs, including her, had to whistle blow on their own chief executive, very unusual case. And so there's this, you know, I'm concerned that there's this theme of the NHS system seems to have actually be excluding and fallen out with the people who were, like, vociferously trying to put patient safety first, which is complicated again. And I think it comes back to some of the things of, well, what do you actually want regulation to solve? Because it might not make it easier to blame managers, which is kind of the device here. I don't know, what do you two think?
Well, I wonder if the reason this has not happened for so long is because effectively NHS managers are often asked to square impossible circles, right? So they're asked to kind of, like, right, you must deliver this service safely with less money. And you go, like, well, that'll be difficult. And my clinical directors aren't going to like that at all. And then they go, oh, and the clinical directors say, yeah, this won't be safe. But at some point, you, the manager, have received an assurance of going, like, look, I've been told to make these savings. This is what we have to do. If there are problems, then we'll just have to hope that doesn't come out. That is often the approach. And then if someone then becomes a whistleblower for saying, oh no, but this is not safe and I can't stand by it, then I wonder if there's not been a more open system of regulation, because really more senior tiers of management of the whole system maybe wouldn't want to see those arguments had in public. Like, at the moment we see that stuff, like, in employment tribunals, where people, I remember, like, kind of, I think the Gary Walker case from more than a decade ago, where people say, look, I was asked to make savings, I didn't think they were safe, I raised that. I wonder if that's why it hasn't happened. And I kind of think, like, probably greater transparency about the realities in the service, whether that's through regulation, probably be a good thing.
Yeah, what it seems to do is it kind of seems to be, the hope seems to be, well, it would partly counterbalance the pressures upon managers to neglect or to sometimes forget about these issues, or, you know, soak them up themselves. But then, well, why not solve the, you know, is the system really going to set something up that would properly do that? And, you know, why not just fix the system in the first place that's leaning on? If so, why not fix the system in the first place that's leaning on people to do that? I suppose a regulator can have a sufficient independence, which the government and NHS England is never going to have that degree of independence.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing that might happen by accident. You accidentally get a system that has a bit more transparency. But, like, it just reminded me of this thing I was reading in some minutes of a mental health trust recently, where the medical director was saying, so this is a mental health trust, like most mental health trusts, that's under tremendous bed pressure. So there's pressure from management to kind of, like, can we discharge people so as we've got the beds free for all of the work that's constantly coming in. And so the minute said, the medical director reported to the board that the consultants believe that we are asking them to make risky discharges, i.e. to push people out before maybe we're happy to have them pushed out. And we consider that a risk. And what it said is, like, oh no, the medical director was at pains to sort of point out that actually what we were asking them to do is to show them that they would be supported in taking that risk, i.e., you know, if you do discharge someone too early and something, you know, in spite of your concerns, and then something does go wrong, hey, you did that, we're not gonna try and get you for that. We're not gonna try and say this is your fault. And that is, like I say, that is the pressure, the sort of impossible, like, circle to square that people are dealing with, kind of day to day. I do think it's the kind of thing that kind of, you know, more transparency can't help but be good, I would have thought, in a scenario, even if it does involve, like you say, creating a whole new profession, you know, and legislation and that kind of thing, because the system as it is, you know, these are just like the cases you hear about, you know, quite often stuff that's deeply concerning when it comes out, and you think like, oh, I wonder what else just got dealt with quietly that maybe shouldn't have done, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Could be part of a cultural change. One thing I wanted to crowbar in here to this discussion was some work we published over the summer, towards the end of August, about turnover in chief executive roles over the last few years, and into trust chief executive roles, because, you know, you can't disconnect the idea of bringing in this kind of regulation from what do we want of our NHS managers, and, you know, how many of them are there? Are there people willing to do these jobs? Are they good people? Do they have sufficient skills and experience? And you know, we were able to demonstrate what I think a lot of people had picked up, that they had since the acute period of COVID ended in 2020. But more or less at the end of 2021, the kind of acute period of COVID concern was ending. Since then, there's been huge turnover of trust chief executives, which means that we found that now there are, of the 201 trusts, 60% of those who have a chief executive for whom it is their first job. So nearly two thirds, you know, have no experience in previous chief exec jobs. Doesn't mean they don't have quite a lot of experience, because some of them might have been in their first job for quite a long time. But of those, 20%, a fifth of all trusts, have someone who is in their first job, and B, has taken up that first role since February 2020. So they're A, in their first job, and pretty new in it. So there's a lot of kind of relatively new and inexperienced people out there. Similarly, 62 trusts, so 31%, have a chief executive who started in that post since February 2022, only the beginning of last year. So it has been demonstrating that huge turnover since that point. Lots of very experienced people retiring, and, you know, there's a lot of I think people make their own judgments about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. Some of our kind of readers commenting on the site said, well, that's good, because, you know, we're getting some new blood in. People can take a fresh approach to these challenges. But equally, you can only see that some of those people were well overdue retirement, should we say, and they were waiting for the pandemic to finish to retire. But some people are leaving because of the mounting pressures and of COVID recovery, and because of all this kind of huge external scrutiny that's coming from a lot of the from Letby, but from many of the kind of scandals that have happened in recent years, maternity scandals, and, you know, just sort of throw in there this over this last week or two, it feels like there's been a real sea change, or the sheer amount of criminal investigations and talk of criminal prosecutions and examples of various of those happening across the service that have really come to a head over the last couple of weeks, brings a real sense of, combined with talk of manager regulation, brings a real sense of that kind of accountability, sharp accountability upon those people.
Yeah, because Nottingham was looking at kind of criminal investigation, and there's a band seven manager charged in a mental health trust in London, plus the trust itself, which is pretty rare, you know.
Rare, but getting more common. yeah, definitely a whole cluster, and I think that's a whole other debate about whether that's the right route to go down, and whether that money, I think sometimes they can result in large fines. I think I don't want to name the trust, as I can't quite remember, but I know there was a record fine that was given, I think maybe last year, it's, yeah, I know that some people are of the view that that money could be better spent elsewhere on,
yeah, you know, well, then you're introducing very stiff, you know, stiff accountability is arguably good, although I wonder whether people just want the visit the appearance of accountability rather than real accountability. So when they get, as Ben says, people looking at the facts and going, well, hang on a minute, it wasn't your fault at all, you know, and the manager then might not come up with it. But a stiff accountability, but also if this is combined with a kind of you know, it's not necessarily going to promote an open culture, but people talk about all the problems that people have with the General Medical Council at the moment, don't they? It's not necessarily going to promote an open and a kind of a culture around improvement and hearing concerns if there's criminalization and kind of punitive approaches across the board. You know, you can argue that both ways, can't you? It may change people's behavior for the better if they're concerned about that sort of thing, but it may stifle things.
And just like a final question kind of to wrap up this section really, but considering all the attention we've kind of you've outlined on managers, is this gonna help recruit and retain good managers in the NHS, or do you think that it could actually result in higher turnover because people are going, there's all too much uncertainty, there's a huge amount of negative attention, I just don't want to do it?
Yeah, I think that's the concern, isn't it, that combines with all the other performance and financial and factors to put people off, and if it's framed in a blamey, you know, NHS managers have got something wrong way, then it puts people off. But, it, you know, and that's why there's all the, everybody who supports it's got this, not everybody, but anyone in the sector who supports it's got this huge proviso of, if it's done right in a way that will actually, you know, promote the image of NHS management and push it up. But I mean, that's a big if.
All right. I think, thanks, Dave. Let's move on to the next subject, which is, I know, an investigation into audiology services, and Ben, you've been covering this one. I think let's perhaps go back to the beginning, a bit of context around this story, kind of what prompted this investigation. I understand it was originally looking at one trust, but now it's been broadened out to more.
Well, so this is specifically paediatric audiology, and so there's a couple of different strands. So kind of there's a newborn screening program. So, you know, when the baby arrives, kind of they do a test, we do a kind of regular screen. And then if there are any sort of concerns, people are referred on to usually the hospital-based paediatric audiology services. Now, this sort of spate of cases in England seems to have been prompted by quite a big case in NHS Lothian, like the Scottish Health Board, a couple of years ago, where it was revealed that quite a lot of children didn't get tested properly, and there were problems with the process, and there might have been some kind of permanent damage. So there's sort of legal, like compensation stuff going on kind of north of the border on that, and probably on the way in England as well. So there was a sort of investigation ordered in England into this. So it's a healthcare science, paediatric audiology, so it kind of does fall under NHS England properly, but they commissioned a sort of, they, after the concerns got raised, they went back to the screening data and just said, all right, can we just have a quick look at this to see of the people that we've screened, how many of them went on to be diagnosed with a problem at the testing stage, i.e. in the different bit of the hospital. And they found four trusts with a kind of much lower than you'd expect diagnosis kind of proportion of kids like found to have these problems. And then on an investigation of those four English trusts, they were like, oh yeah, no, significant problems in the process. So like just like in record keeping, in the way tests were done, in some cases in equipment use. So that's at four English trusts. And then subsequent to that, another two that we know about, NHS England being typically very opaque about this, and another two either came forward or were sort of referred to the program. So as it stands, on his last day, I think, on the 31st of August, Dave Slemon left. He wasn't in post at the start of September. He and the chief scientific officer for NHS England wrote to all the ICBs to say, please assure yourself that that your providers are like doing this job properly, in effect, because there has been problems, and the story. We first reported it focusing on Croydon, which is the first trust to admit to kind of serious patient harm as a result. Well, it's kind of, they say there's a risk of serious patient harm for three patients. The NHS, as some of you might know, has this kind of odd and largely unevenly applied process for assessing patient harm, which is weird considering it's so important, right? And Croydon, one of the trusts that were added to the program later on, and the story this week is just as we get more confirmations of like the number of children who've had to be reviewed, the number of other children who come to harm, like we found cases of serious harm at two other trusts so far, and it raises a load of issues really, because this is these departments usually aren't that big, you know, kind of between 4 and 14 person units as a rule, and a sort of a measure of the level of oversight that NHS England has had on this historically, you can kind of gauge from just which is like one word in the letter they sent out in the Sloman and Hill letter from the end of August, right? Third paragraph, they say, we know there are approximately 130 paediatric hearing services across the 42 ICBs. And currently only 25 of these services are accredited. It's just the word approximately that you sort of hope that the National System Oversight Body would know exactly how many paediatric hearing services there were across the ICBs. So part of the concern is that, like they say in their letter, only 25 of those are accredited, and that actually, in the beginning of the last decade, decision was taken to sort of remove the requirement for inspection of these services. So, and these often aren't particularly like high profile services. So you could, in perfectly good faith, have completed your audiology degree, got a job at NHS Trust running audiology, providing audiology services, paediatric audiology services, and then been doing it wrong for up to a decade, and there would be no mandatory inspection or accreditation that would pick that up. So, you know, there is a concern that actually you if you're going to be very thorough about this, you would look back over the whole of the past decade to see where harm where people might have been missed, because if you miss this, then obviously there's problems, there are potentially problems with sociability and learning, and potentially people being misdiagnosed with other things because the hearing issue wasn't picked up. It's a little bit concerning that kind of that the process has been left to ICBs, which, you know, have a lot on, like not that NHS England doesn't, but the assurance process centrally seems to be, let's say I was the minister, you'd be like, well, how am I assured that how are parents in England to be assured that these services are doing their job right? It's like, well, I've instructed NHS England to look at it. NHS England have written to the 42 ICBs and said, you look at it, and then it's not clear if they are going to refer people up to like the National Working Group, which has, like we say, as far as we know, six trusts referred to it so far, but it's quite concerning.
Do you think the scope of the review is wide enough? Do you think it should be going back more than 10 years? Because it seems like quite an arbitrary point at which to sort of start doing this investigation, maybe.
Well, so they're effectively relying on people being referred into this like working group. And when they get referred into the working group, then kind of they do get an external visit from one of the professional bodies involved in this, usually the BAA. But that sort of relies on either self-referral or like other trust referring themselves to it, which has happened in a couple of cases, or being picked up, or someone else referring them in, or the ICBs saying, all right, well, we wrote to people and gone, are we services safe? And they've gone, oh, actually, we're not. Okay, well, that, when you're in as well. But that's sort of a less than entire assurance, I'd say. And kind of like, so the initial review based on the screening, so that's the point of birth data, that looked at 2018 to 2023. But there is an argument that you should maybe go, you should look further back to when the mandatory inspection and accreditation procedures were removed in 2013. And in fact, there was a sort of rapid review done by a bunch of the professional associations, National Deaf Children's Society, British Academy of Audiology, in 2020, where they expressed like fairly serious concerns about a lack of oversight at a national level with pediatric audiology.
I wonder as well, do you think there are other, as you described, kind of quite low-key services in hospitals that might have the same kind of have the same problems that are yet to be uncovered?
I think it's entirely possible, because if you think of sort of the oversight procedures, like so much of like quality in NHS services depends on the people in the service. And so it goes back to our earlier conversation, being able to go like, hey, this doesn't look right. And maybe, you know, maybe that gets reported by them, maybe it doesn't, kind of like, and for one of a number of reasons, maybe it wouldn't do, you know, I don't want to be blamed for this. And then if it does get reported up to your next tier of management, kind of, does the right thing get done about that? You know, is there the resource? Does like managers have to balance very constrained resources all the time? So I think there's a real risk, especially in the sort of the ones where there is no official mandatory oversight. And like I say, this isn't a medically delivered service, although there is some like input sometimes from ENT departments, but not always. It seems like one that could really have fallen through the gaps.
Right, I think that's a good point to wrap up the podcast this week. But thanks very much, Ben and Dave. And just a reminder to listeners, our podcast is available every week on our website and wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to get in touch with us if there's something you'd like us to cover. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.